All right, well, we are continuing in our Advent worship or sermon series, worship series. It is about worship, called Come to Worship. And I'm really thankful for and excited for this sermon series specifically. In 2008, I was invited by the youth pastor that I was under as a volunteer staff to go on an international mission trip, a cross-cultural mission trip. He asked me in like February to pray about going in July with him and a team of youth and a few other adults to the city of Chihuahua in Chihuahua, Mexico, which is on the mainland, and it's kind of this big central state just below Texas. It's actually rather massive, and I did. I prayed about it. I was excited about going. I said yes to going, and the way John led a mission trip, John and his wife Janelle, was that they spent an extended amount of time preparing with the team to go. So not only was it a trip down there, but there was a journey that you went on to get ready for the trip as a team and individually. And my experience that week down in Chihuahua was one of those times in my life where God met with me in that time, and he did a great work in my life. He changed some of my perspectives, the way I thought about life, the attitude that I had about the world around me. And so I came back a different person than I went down there being. Now that's an incredible thing, right? I mean, it's hard to change a person. And sometimes the older we get, the harder it is to change. You've probably heard the expression, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. The truth is it's hard for humans to learn new tricks when they're the core habits of our being. But some of those habits changed in that week because of what God did. And so I came back just feeling amazing with an incredibly different perspective on my life and the purpose of and direction for my life. And afterwards, I was talking with John, and I was just thanking him so much for inviting me and sharing my thankfulness and praise to God for what he did in that week. And John shared something with me in that conversation that surprised me and challenged me. He said, the thing about leading these trips, because he and his wife would lead them every year as a youth pastor and youth pastor's wife, is that many people go and they experience this massive spiritual high, this mountain peak experience where they get very close to the Lord and they feel his presence and they feel like they're changing. And then they come back and then all of that slowly wanes like the sun setting, right? That's kind of what he was saying. He didn't use the sunsetting analogy. That was in my brain right now. But that change dissipates over time. And he said that the trick is realizing that what you experienced in that week isn't abnormal for followers of Jesus and is actually something that you can learn to cultivate in your life on a more regular basis. And I was like, whoa. I mean, think about that. What he was saying is that the closeness that I experienced to God that week, which is hard for you to imagine if you've never experienced that before, but the internal things that are happening when God is close to you give you a great deal of satisfaction and peace and joy and goodness, the type of things that you want in your life on a regular basis. And he said, you can have that often in your life. And I thought, wow, I could have that more often. Then I also thought, wow, the people that we lead could have that more often. What would it take? And I started to reflect on what happened in me that week and what it took to cultivate that in me that week. And one of the things that I realized that happened is over the course of all the training that we did, I started to think about the world as someone who was called to give to the world and not to take from the world. I was being called to live a life of generously spending myself for the sake of others. And as I read the Bible and I saw that as a person who was called to be a disciple of Jesus, that I was called to also be on mission with Jesus, and I was called to love like Jesus, and as I said yes to that in my heart, yes to that to my team members, yes to that to the people that we served as a team before we went down, and even more so yes to that when I was in Mexico, that I was changed into somebody who was a giver of themselves. And that whole time when I was on that trip, I was giving. I was giving because before I went, I knew that's what I was going to be asked to do when I was down there, and I trained for that. And so from 6 a.m. till 10 p.m. every day, I gave of myself. I gave of myself to lead students in the morning and to serve them and to help them and do devotions sometimes. I gave myself to making concrete in the hot Mexican sun so that the local workers could lay tile and level floors. I gave of myself to rest in the middle of the day when I was so excited for what was coming next. I gave of myself to lead VBS in the afternoon and early evening. I gave of myself so that when I was tired at the end of the day, when I was full of delicious tacos and I wanted to go to sleep, that I would sit with the team and debrief with them and celebrate the moments that they saw God working and the things that they were thankful for and share of myself. I signed up for 7 days of giving myself, and that 7 days of giving changed me into somebody that was more like Jesus, because Jesus is the one who gives of himself first, right? That's what 1 John says in 1 John 4, that we love because he first loved us. That the love that is formed in us is formed because of the experience of the love of Jesus that we had. Today, I want to invite you into a journey of giving. A journey that can change your life if you say yes each step of the way. Now, I also know that I'm inviting you into a very daring and dangerous journey as part of that. Because the problem with giving yourself is what? You risk losing yourself. Right? But the beauty of that is that Jesus says, as we lose ourselves for his sake, we find so much more than we ever thought we would lose when we let go of ourselves for him. And so today, we're talking about this journey of giving as we study the story of the wise men. And so will you pray with me as we get ready to enter into the Lord's word? Father, we thank you for this time that you have prepared for us right now. We know, Father, that you long for us to know you, your heart of love, the life that you desire us to have. We know that you gave your Son so that we could live. We know, Father, that as we follow you, you call us to give. And not just to give in small ways, but to give deeply. And yet, Father, we also know that this is dangerous territory for us because it feels like a risk. It feels like we might be in loss because of our sacrifice. So, Father, fill us with faith. Grow our perspective. Change our attitudes. Press your word into us and let us be formed by it and the Spirit of your Son. Use this time, Lord, to grow us and change us. We thank you for this time that we have with you. In Jesus' name, amen. So we're continuing to study the story of the wise men in Matthew chapter 2, and so let's read that. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of King Herod, wise men came from the east and arrived in Jerusalem, saying, "Where is he who has been born the King of the Jews? For we saw his star at its rising and have come to worship him." Okay, I want to pause here and unpack a little bit of the Christmas story and just talk about some of the things that sometimes go wrong in our own retelling of the Christmas story. So I remember as a kid setting up the nativity scene. Anybody do that as a little kid or even as an adult? You get all the figures out on the nativity scene. And we had like this huge cavalcade of individuals that would go into the nativity scene. And it was like a menagerie of different characters that were collected from different stores over time when my dad was a kid. So it was that old. And so we had like shepherd's boys from England and from Africa. And we had like dogs and camels and cows and sheep and goats and various animals and all sorts of people from around the world were a part of this nativity scene. And every year, I remember getting the animals in and the shepherds, and then right after that, the wise men were there. So I kind of made like this concentric circle of timeline, and everybody was at the party, right? And then my family was one of those families that we didn't put baby Jesus in till Christmas morning. So if you were setting up the nativity scene, you got to hide baby Jesus, but you had to tell mom and dad where you hid it for when you forgot where you hid it, so that we had Jesus on Christmas morning. And so we had baby Jesus, and we would hide him, and then you would get to put baby Jesus in the nativity either late on Christmas Eve when you were old enough to stay up late with mom and dad, or first thing Christmas morning. And it was really special. but I remember thinking that in my head, the Christmas story basically went like this. Mary got pregnant from the Lord, right? And then 9 months later, they had to go to Nazareth, and they went there, and there was no room in the inn, so then they went to the barn, right, the stable, and then she gave birth in the barn, and there were animals in the barn already, and then angels appeared to the shepherds at night, and they said that the Lord was born, the Savior was born. They sent the shepherds into town to look for a baby wrapped in swaddling clothes, whatever swaddling clothes were, right? Because you're eight, you don't know what that is. And so then that meant shepherds in town, and then the animals that were at the barn. And then the angels showed up, because the angels said glory to God in the highest and peace to his people on earth, and you know, the whole thing. And then the wise men showed up, and then they brought gifts, and that was like Christmas Day, like December 25th, 0 AD, right? Like that's what you think happens when you're a little kid. At least that's what my naive brain said. But we know that Jesus wasn't born on December 25th, right? It's like an arbitrary day that we grabbed for various reasons that really aren't significant. But we celebrate Christ's birth as a world on that day specifically. And we know beyond that that the wise men didn't actually arrive in Bethlehem the day that Jesus was born, right? That they arrived much later. In this story here, it says that the wise men arrive in Jerusalem after Jesus' birth. And listen to the tense. Where is he who has been born King of the Jews? So it's after Jesus' birth. And then they say, we saw his star at its rising and have come to worship him. In other words, they're saying, we saw in the stars, in the sky, the moment of Jesus' birth. And when we saw that, we left to come here. And so they're on a journey, and it took some time. And so in verse 3, it says, when King Herod heard this, he was deeply disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him. So he assembled all the chief priests and the scribes of the people and asked them where the Christ would be born. And so this birth was a surprise to Herod, and it had already happened. And the wise men left when Jesus was born, and they went on this great journey to get there. Now here's another thing. Christmas is a positive and happy time, right? And so we don't focus on the nasty details of this story a little bit. But you've got this character, King Herod, and his disturbed nature causes the whole town around him to be disturbed with him. And so when Herod finds out about this king, he's deeply concerned because he's the king and he wants to be the king. And Herod is the kind of guy that has wealth and power and uses those to his own advantage as often as he perceives there's a need. And so this King Herod has actually killed family members to maintain his position of power. That's a pretty despicable human being, right? At least in our culture's values, to do such a thing, that I would say that my right to be in control is more important than your right to live. Wow, that is incredibly harsh, isn't it? And so Herod's a second form of Pharaoh. We don't have time for that. Herod is interested in finding baby Jesus to kill Jesus to maintain his dominance over the culture. Wow. And the people of Jerusalem are disturbed, because if Herod is disturbed, they have good reason to be concerned. Because when Herod gets disturbed, people suffer and die. And so this is a really dark entrance into the world. It's not a pretty backdrop. It's not romantic. There's no angels singing here, right? Like these are the clouds of war and doom are forming. And so this is how the wise men come in. Now the other thing that I would point out in this is that it doesn't say that the wise men followed the star from the east, right? So like Iran, Iraq, that region. They probably came from over there. We don't actually know. It doesn't say that they saw from the east a star in the west, or from the west a star in the east. It actually says we saw the star they saw the stars rising in the sky, and they knew this significant event happened. And because they were able to discern from that this king was born in Israel, they went to the capital of Israel, Jerusalem, because that's where kings are born, right? So they followed deduction to Jerusalem, not a star. But that doesn't rhyme in a song, right? Like, what rhymes with deduction? Like, reduction. It's just not, no good. So let's just have them follow a star, because that sounds better in American Christmas songs. And so we're kind of unraveling it, but we're building a true story at the same time. In Bethlehem of Judea, all the people around Herod tell him, because this is what was written by the prophet. And you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, because out of you will come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. Wow. So we know where the Messiah, the king, is supposed to be born. They knew that this was happening. And this was announced in the courts of Herod a little bit after Jesus' birth. This is an incredible promise. We'll probably unpack it a little bit over the next couple weeks. And then Herod secretly summoned the wise men and asked them the exact time the star appeared. So Herod, that conniving, insecurity, megalomaniac guy, is trying to figure out how do I get a hold of this and control this? And so he's asking for details. He's goading them for information so that he can take care of a problem. And he sent them to Bethlehem, knowing this information, and said, "Go and search carefully for the child. And when you find him, report back to me so that I too can go and worship him." But we all know, like, we see through Herod, right? Like, we're not like, "Oh, what a nice guy. He likes Jesus too." No, like, he's kind of like scum of the earth type fellow, and he's a bad guy in this story. And so he is lying to these wise men. Well, after hearing the king, they went on their way, and there it was, the star that they had seen at its rising. Wow. So they didn't follow the star to Jerusalem, but all of a sudden the star is there and it's guiding them again. And it led them until it came and stopped above the place the child was. Now we're gonna nerd out a little bit more on the Bible here, if that's okay with you. So you can push your glasses back, gentlemen, and put the pocket protectors in. It's gonna be a good ride. So There are a group of people that when they look at the Bible, they read it, and they read things that happen in it, and they read these supernatural stories. In other words, these stories that we can't explain through natural phenomena happening on earth, and that troubles them. The universe is governed by laws of thermodynamics and physics, and those laws can't be broken. They are immutable, and even God can't break those laws in these people's minds, if there is a God. And so they read stories, and they start to take away from these stories the supernatural intervention of God to guide history to the ends that he desires. That was a mouthful, but it's important to recognize that God does that. He's in the redemption business. And so he's redeeming human history by stepping in over and over again where needed to guide history to a successful conclusion from his perspective. This is a good thing. This is part of why we trust God, right? It's why we have hope. Because we see he has the ability to do this. But this group of people, when they read these events in the Bible, they try to unravel them. And so if you read an article by these people, and they do show up in like popular magazines from time to time, at least in quotations, they'll say things like, "Now, when Moses was leading Israel through the wilderness and Pharaoh is chasing him, it's not actually the Red Sea that they encounter. That's a mistranslation and a scribal error. It's actually the Sea of Reeds," and then they'll like bust out a little map and they'll be like, "Here's the Red Sea," and you can see that if they go to the Red Sea, it's really out of the way. So it's probably more likely that they took the direct route, because that's always how God works. He takes the simplest, shortest route, right? And so they probably would have ended up at this little lake that we like to call the Sea of Reeds. Now, the Sea of Reeds was filled with reeds. Hey, you all been to Trout Lake, Washington? Is there a lake there anymore? What happened? Grass sucked up all the water. That's essentially what's going on with the Sea of Reeds. So the Sea of Reeds is there, and they'll say, "And then in the spring when this happened, there would have been a great wind from the north, and if the tides were right and the moon was wrong, then the water would have been incredibly shallow, and so a wind came up and the tide went out and the Israelites were able to walk on squishy ground. But we'll call it dry ground by comparison. But when Pharaoh got there with his cavalry and his chariots, they were too heavy. And so when they hit the Sea of Reeds, they stuck in it like glue, like dentures to Fixident, right? And so then they drowned in the waters that were so shallow that the Israelites could walk through, right? And so there's a little bit of logical hole in this, but they're desperately trying to make the Bible make sense from human perspective only, without trusting in a divine and all-powerful God. And so these same scholars take stories like the star rising in the east, and they try to figure out when this could happen, and so they'll say something like, well, Jesus was probably born in like 7 BC because there are Chinese astronomers who note that there was a special astrological event and a very bright star that formed in the east at that time, and then they like wind back. I think scientists are brilliant, by the way, and I love science because they can do things like this. They can roll back time in the stars, and they can predict where astral bodies are in order to create an event that would form a bright star in the sky. And they can figure out that approximately around 7 BC at some point in time, Jupiter and Mars and Saturn would have aligned and formed a bright star in the night sky that was more brilliant than any other astral body in the star at that point, or the sky at that point in time. Isn't it amazing that they can do that, right? But does that mean that that was the star? No, right? That'd be like me finding a dollar bill today and being like, this is the first dollar bill I ever made. Yeah, it's a dollar bill, but how? Really? Like I can just, this is the one. I wrote the serial number down or something. I don't know. I can't prove it, and they can't prove it either, and they're providing conjecture because they have doubt. And rather than trusting what's written in the Bible, they would trust their own minds and what is apparently real. And that's not faith. And so we look at this story and we say, wow, so they saw the star in the east, or they saw the star in the sky, and then this star rose for them to go to Bethlehem, and it guided them to Bethlehem, and it moved with them. Now, this is another nerdy moment in the Bible, because at this point in time, this is reminding Jewish learners of another story where God appeared as a source of light, a pillar of fire by night to guide and protect the Israelites. And he was taking them on a journey of salvation, a journey of deliverance out of Egypt and slavery into the promised land. We also know that the author of Hebrews says that Jesus is our promised land rest when we put our faith in him. And that in Christ we receive a massive inheritance. We receive the new heaven and the new earth. And in him we will rest from all of our labors and the works of our salvation, because he'll provide salvation. And so we're seeing this story overlay, which, by the way, is something that Jewish people loved to do at this point in time. They loved double and triple and quadruple meaning. They loved leaving little hooks off that would grab your mind and remind you of other stories in the Bible so that you would be thinking of God more and more even after you heard what they shared or what they wrote. And so this light is guiding them just like God has done before. Now, we don't know if this was a physical star. We don't know if it was a planet. We don't know if it was an angel. We don't know that if it was like God giving heaven a cesarean section and he took his God scalpel and just popped a little hole and plopped Jesus through the hole and the light of heaven was breaking through. I mean, we don't know what it was. But we know that God provided a light that guided these men to the place that they needed to be. And that light was the grace of his revelation. And the light stopped where Jesus was and took them directly there. When they saw the star, they were overwhelmed with joy. And entering the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother, and falling to their knees, they worshiped him. Wow. I want you to think about this for just a minute. When you bring a baby to church, who googles and ahs and wows over that baby? Well, everybody, but who's the most? Grandmas and other women, right? Teenage girls. Men typically the least, right? In fact, that there are some men who are like, yeah, that's a baby, all right. You made one of them. Yes, you did. And varying degrees of liking babies. But these guys, this baby is so special in their eyes that they worship him. That's a special thing in and of itself that we'll unpack a little bit more in a minute. And then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts, gold and frankincense and myrrh. And so today we're talking about bringing your gifts. Bringing your gifts is part of worship. That's what Matthew wants us to see. That's what the Lord wants us to see in this. He's guiding us to this point where we see that when we really worship Jesus, part of that worship is to give Jesus gifts. Now, that can be challenging for some of us, and some of us are already regretting coming to church today, right? Because you like giving sermons are your least favorite sermons, and sometimes they're my least favorite sermons too, because the last thing I would like for you to think is that for some reason I am saying, open your wallet and give me or our church money. That's not the goal of this. That's not the point of this. In this church, I have the blessing of being freed from knowing what anyone gives financially to the church. It's a great thing. It's written into our constitution and bylaws that the only person in the church who knows what you give is the treasurer, and he does his best to not even worry and think about it, that because that's between you and the Lord, not between you and us. See, Jesus wants us to know that part of worship is bringing your gifts, because he wants you to know his love. He wants you to know his fullness. And he knows unless if you become a giver, you won't experience that, because you're not living fully in the love of God. Now, we're going to unpack that idea a little bit more as we move through the sermon, but that's why we're talking about this today. We're not talking about this today because we want your money. That's not what it's all about. We're talking about this because Jesus wants your heart, and he wants you to know his heart for you. And so let's learn from the wise men. First, we see that when they saw the star, the wise men were overwhelmed with joy. Wow. When they saw the star, they were overwhelmed with joy. Now, I want you to think about this from the perspective of the wise men a little bit. The wise men had just gone on a great and long journey, probably in a camel caravan, from wherever they were in the east to Jerusalem. Now, there's a good chance that journey was around 5 to 550 miles. It may have been as long as 900 miles. Now, that doesn't seem like a lot to you and I, right? Because we can hop in our car, and we can hit cruise control at 70 miles an hour, and we can cover 500 miles in less than 8 hours with a pee-pee stop in the middle, right? Like, we can take care of that very quickly. But that's not the case for these wise men on this camel caravan journey. Now, inquiring minds are probably wanting to know at this point in time, just what was it like on a camel caravanning journey? Well, thankfully, a guy in 1928 went to China and studied camel caravans for about a year and then wrote an informative scholarly book about it. Aren't you so happy? You can't get this on Amazon, but you might be able to find it on eBay for a nerd that you love, okay? So this guy, he studied camels and he wrote this book, and it turns out that there's a lot to running a camel caravan. So in 1928 in China, and this was not new information, this is something that he said had been passed down from generation to generation, and that the terms for the different people and the jobs and the position in the caravan were in Chinese and were in Arabic and were in Sanskrit, that they were across many cultures, because these caravans had traveled much of the Eastern world between China and even parts of Europe and the Middle East and Africa, so that this was kind of a ubiquitous thing that he discovered as he journeyed with them. And so essentially a caravan was made up to 8 different lines of camels, and each row had up to 18 camels, or each column had up to 18 camels in that column. So they could be traveling with like 144 camels. And these camels wouldn't have been carrying people, they would have been carrying goods, because that's what caravans did. They were trading caravans. And so these wise men would have been traveling with a trading caravan of up to 144 camels. Now, each column had at the front of it the camel guide. And this was a person who in 1928 was paid like $1 a week. And the guy said it wasn't even enough to pay for their shoes and their clothes that they would have worn out on this journey. But they would have had an opportunity to stow cargo in the caravan and sell that at the places they arrived. So they were like early wheelers and dealers, is essentially what these guys were. And they would take a rope and they would guide their column of camels to where they wanted them to go. Now, have any of you worked with beasts of burden before? Like donkeys, mules, things like this? Do they do what you want them to do automatically? No, like quite the opposite, right? In fact, they really don't want to do what you want to do at least half the time, and so it can be very frustrating. So they've got this big rope, and they're leading this camel with a halter and a bit, and they're pulling it along, and then that camel has tied to its cargo another rope that goes to the front end of the camel behind it, and so on and so on and all the way down. Can you imagine being this guy and having to pull 18 camels in the direction that they should go? It probably was a lot like being a one-man locomotive, right? Like, camel number four wants to stop. What are you doing? You're stopping, right? Like, this doesn't work out. Camels are probably worse than trying to herd toddlers, preschoolers, right? Like, how many of you have traveled with a gaggle of children before, and you stop at the gas station, and you're like, okay, everybody, it's time to potty. Let's go inside and potty. And then, like, you say this 15 times, and like, there's still that one kid who's like, what are we doing here? And you're like, oh, my word. Were you not listening? I was, but I forget it. Okay. We're going to the bathroom right now. This is what you need to do. And then everybody says they went to the bathroom. You get everybody back in the car. And then like a mile and a half later, Timmy in the bath is like, back is like, I have to go pee right now or I will pee in my seat. Right? And you have to pull over the van. You get everybody out. You get Timmy on the side of the road. Go to the bathroom. You get everybody back in. You're on the road again. It's very frustrating at times. Also kind of funny, but frustrating at times. Camels. They don't speak English. They don't speak Chinese. They don't speak Arabic. Can you imagine? Okay, we're coming to the oasis. Every camel needs to drink 4 gallons of water and use the bathroom. Right. So 5 minutes later, camel number 12 has to stop and do everything right there in the middle of the trail. And they're the first column. So now all the other columns have to go around camel number 12's business. This is not an easy way to travel. It's frustrating and challenging. Not only that, but you travel when it's best to travel. So if it's hot as blazes outside, you travel at night. If there's a storm coming because the seasons are changing, you travel until it's safe to stop. You're traveling odd hours and long hours, and you're traveling at the pace that a man can drag a column of camels, about 25 miles over a 12-hour day. Oof. This is grueling travel. There's no air conditioning. There's no flight attendant. There's no coat check. It's challenging and difficult and dangerous. And so these guys arrive at Jerusalem having had a grueling journey of hundreds of miles. By the way, that's the distance. Can you imagine walking from here to San Francisco with a whole group of camels? And that's essentially what they did. That's a long trip, right? And so they get to Jerusalem, and then they talk with this king who's a rather fierce and gruesome despot, as it turns out, and he's not really trustworthy, and they would have known his reputation, and they have to tangle with him and deal with his web of lies and play the political game and find out the information they need to know. How happy are you at this point in time with your journey? Probably not very happy, right? I have seen adults throw adult tantrums over a 5-minute delay in the TSA line, right? Can you imagine like a 2.5-week delay of camel? Boy, you wouldn't be too happy. And then they find out they have to go to another place, but thankfully it's really close. And instead of having to search for the house, they get early GPS, right? There's a star shining where to go, and it never has to recalculate. It just takes them right where they should go. And they get to the house, and when they get there at the end of this grueling and challenging journey, instead of feeling tired, it says that they're feeling overwhelmed with joy. Now, this is a deeply special thing, that they are overwhelmed with joy at meeting this newborn king, who probably isn't an infant anymore, but somewhere in the age of 2 to 3. And so they have all of this excitement. Now, the thing is that in our English translation, we get 2 words about this, overwhelming joy, or maybe 3, overwhelmed with joy. But in the original text, 4 words were designated for this. But if you translate the Bible in a literal or wooden sense, sometimes it doesn't make the most sense in English. So it's a participial phrase, and a participial phrase means that the Greek is doing like linguistic gymnastics, and it's making a verb into a noun. And so it's a noun that contains the idea of action or something occurring. That's kind of a weird thing. We call that a gerund, and most of you don't even know what that is anymore because 6th grade was so long ago that you happily forget it, right? And so it's this action noun. It's like the superhero of nouns. It's the noun that every noun wants to be when it grows up. And so it's this idea of having, but having in the nounal form. Nounal is a form, I guess. So it's like an ongoing action that you possess inside of you. Having mega. That's the next word, just mega. Anybody know what mega means? Big, great, a lot, right? Some of you grew up in the 80s and you played Mega Man, the video game, and he was like an awesome man, like a lot of man, even though he was tiny. So there's Mega Man, there's mega, having mega joy. Now, what is joy? How would we define joy? Often in our culture, joy is sort of a form of happiness and euphoria, right? Like the feeling that you get when you go to your accountant in mid-February and you find out you're getting a return. You're like, yay, money that I didn't have to give to the government, but they gave back to me. Isn't this a wonderful day? And so you like feel happy about this, right? Or like the happiness you feel when you realize that the barista at Starbucks didn't blow your drink and make it with caffeine and sugar, so you don't have to see your cardiologist the next day. Hooray! Right? And so we count joy as temporary feeling based on short-term circumstances. But the joy that is talked about in the Bible is much greater than that. It's not just a momentary feeling, but it's a deep feeling from the deepest parts of who you are. And so cultures around Israel at this time used linguistic phrases to describe joy, because if they just gave it a word, it didn't really paint what was really happening. And so one culture says, joy is when you're dancing inside of your heart. Right? And so guys, you should write that down in the margin of your notes for your Valentine's Day card, okay? Like, you make me dance in my heart. Okay, you're welcome. You don't even have to tip me for that. And then another culture says that joy is when I'm shouting with happiness from in my heart. Like I'm not just feeling happy in the moment, like in my heart I'm overflowing like a volcano of happy. And so I just have this excitement and this wonder about what's going on right now. So it's like I have this overwhelming super amount of inner excitement, and then it says in exceedingliness. And we don't really use the word exceedingliness in our culture, and it's probably a rough translation. We would say exceedingly, but it's not really fitting, because exceeding is like, I don't know, it's inadequate. It's this overflowing. It's this river that's gushing out. It's a floodgate that's been opened. That's how much joy is here in these men. And so we see that the heart of their giving starts with being overwhelmed with joy at what God is doing. Now, this is really the foundation of giving for us as believers. In fact, I would put it in this way. Gratitude is the attitude that will be the foundation of your giving. That if you do not possess gratitude, you will not be a good giver. Because if you do not possess gratitude, and specifically gratitude towards God because of the great gift that he has given you in Christ, then you exist in a position of greed or an attitude of greed. And if you have greed in your heart instead of gratitude as your motivation for life, the desire to get more for yourself or to have more, which, by the way, is what America is built on, right? Greed and a great desire to achieve more for ourselves and the people around us. If that's your mode of giving, then you're giving to get back. Is that ever real giving? Has anybody ever given you a gift that you can tell is a gift with strings attached? Here's the gift, and now I expect you to do these things for me. That's actually negotiation, right? That's not really giving. And so true giving starts when we're overwhelmed with joy and we develop this gratitude in ourselves, so that giving has a foundation or a platform. It's something that builds at that point in time, not something that takes at that point in time. And then we see that the wise men come to worship him, and therefore they bring their gifts. So as we read stories in the Bible, it's important that we look at them like something that's being built over time, and it grows like a house, like something you build out of Legos, like a car. Many of you have built or created crafts on many things, and so you understand this a little bit. If you start to knit a sweater, it doesn't look like a sweater at the beginning, and at the end it does, right? You're building it over time, and stories are the same way. Well, we have to remember that this story has been being built from the start of the gospel and is continuing to build after that, but that this story can stand alone. And as we think and see this context, it becomes bigger for us than it is if we just read it through and forget these details. So we have to go back and we have to remember that the wise men told Herod that they wanted to see the newborn king, that they might worship him. And then we have to connect the giving of the gifts at the end with the worship. Otherwise, these things get disconnected and they lose a lot of their power. They lose their significance. And so this little story is being told so that we will learn about worshiping this newborn king. Not only that, but as we think about the context of the story, we see that there are good guys and there's a bad guy. So who's the bad guy of the story? Herod, right? And he's like kind of a wicked, despicable guy. And after the story, you read that Herod basically went into the town and figured out how old Jesus would have been and just killed every son at that age to just make sure that there wasn't going to be a problem politically for him. He's a really bad guy. Who are the heroes of the story? The wise men, right? These magi from the east. And so when you read a story, do you want to be like the antagonist, the bad guy, or the protagonist, the good guy? You want to be like the good guy. Yeah, exactly, right? Some of you are like, oh, actually, I kind of like being the bad guy. But yeah, that's a different issue, and you could talk to your therapist about that on Tuesday or whenever you're going to see them. And you should if you like being the bad guy. Anyway, so I just should it on you. Please forgive me. You can talk to your therapist about that the next Tuesday, and it'll work out. I'll talk to mine about it this Tuesday instead, why I ramble at the mouth like this. So the good guys are giving gifts, and we are to be like the good guys. And the good guys are giving gifts out of a heart of worship for the Savior. And so that's really the heart of this message, that we see that Matthew wants us to be like these good guys and bring our gifts. Now, who was Matthew before he became a disciple? Does anybody remember the occupation he had? He was a tax collector. Were tax collectors popular people in Israel at the time? No, they were incredibly unpopular people. They were more unpopular than present-day IRS agents because they were incredibly dishonest. They made their money. If you're an IRS agent, you see me after church. We'll figure this out. It's okay if that's your job. They made money by grafting it, or they would extort it from the people that they were taxing. So in other words, when they purchased their license to become a tax collector, and that's what it was. It was a business, and the Romans knew there was big money in tax collecting. So they put tax collecting out to bid like every decade or a certain period periodically. And then when you bid on that, then you got the right to collect taxes over that region, and you could set up a series of henchmen to enforce taxation. And the Romans had a certain amount that they demanded. And then above that, if you collected above that, that was all yours. So whatever you could get out of people became your profit in this business, and you were in this business for profit. So essentially, Matthew was a professional extortioner, and we don't know if he was the strong guy or the lean or the brains behind it. He was probably the brains, though, because he was in the tax office, right? He wasn't around the street shaking it up. He was at the crossroads taxing all the goods when he met Jesus. Now, that made Matthew a wealthy man. I find it incredibly interesting that in the gospel that Matthew wrote, he starts by addressing what we do with our wealth when we meet Jesus. It's like Matthew has discovered a deep part of his relationship with Jesus is to turn from someone who is greedy and wants to get into someone who is interested in giving. And he wants those of us who would fall in his position in life to know that right off the bat. That's a rather interesting set of coincidences, isn't it? The other thing that Matthew records, well, really the Lord through Matthew, is that he tells us what the gifts were. He tells us that the gifts were gold and frankincense and myrrh. Now, this isn't explained, but a lot of people have thought a long time about what this means, and they've connected some dots here. So we'll do that briefly, and then we'll move on. First of all, gold was something that someone from one royal court would have given to another royal court when a child was born. It would have been a gift of acknowledgement and celebration. It would have been starting this child off on a foundation of their own treasury. So it would have been a gift for the child, and it would have been a noble gift. It would have been enabling them to become noble and generous, overseeing their people from a foundation of wealth, which is important when you're a noble, some sort of wealth. It doesn't have to be physical. It can be wealth of a heart as well. Next, there was frankincense. Now, frankincense was like the resin of a plant, and it was often used for incense when offering prayers to a deity. And so there are some theologians who think that this gift pointed to the fact that Jesus was going to become our high priest, that Jesus wasn't just born a king, but he was also born a priest. That's pretty cool. And then the third gift, myrrh, was another plant resin, and it was used in embalming dead bodies, which would be a creepy gift to give to a toddler, right? Like, that's not so good. But if it pointed to something that was going to happen in this toddler's life as a way of prophesying about his future death and resurrection, well, now it becomes a beautiful thing, right? And so there are some theologians who think that this points to those three things. That is never recorded anywhere in the Gospels, but it makes sense logically, right? And so we'll just go, hey, that's a neat thing, and then we'll move on. Now, there's a bigger thing that's here, okay? Throughout the Old Testament, no messenger from God, no one who is sent from God, who is not God, accepts worship and sacrifices or gifts. And that's what's going on here. So, there are points in the Old Testament where an angel appears, and the person who sees the angel is first afraid and then decides, oh, I should probably worship now. And at that point in time, the angel's like, don't worship me. I'm just a servant of the one that you should worship. So don't worship me. And they also say the same things about offerings and gifts. I cannot accept this. I do not receive offerings. Those are for the Lord. The infant Christ, God's Messiah, receives the worship and he receives the gifts. So not only is Matthew saying that Jesus is born a king, that these wise men are coming to see, he's also saying that this king is God because he receives the worship and receives the gifts. Do you see the connection there? Now, this might not be too important to you unless if you are a Bible nerd like myself, but it might be important to you, say a friend or a family member comes and starts to tell you things like, the Bible never says that Jesus is God. And you'd be like, well, actually, that's your pocket protector going in. It does. And let me show you where. And you can bring them to here. And you can say, now it's not explicit, but it's so implicit that the author had no need to say it explicitly. Right? It's so woven into the text of the culture that they didn't need to shout it and drop the mic. They could just weave it in the story and watch it come to life. That's pretty cool, huh? So we're already seeing that Matthew is building this argument that Jesus is God. Anyways, let's get back to the main point. These wise men come to worship Christ, and therefore they bring him gifts. Now let's talk about giving and gifts. Love gives. Love gives. It's kind of a simple, pithy thing, but I'd like to drill it a little more deeply. Christmas is a holiday that is all about giving, right? How many of you already have presents at home, wrapped, you're ready to give them to the people? Maybe they're under the tree, maybe they're not. Okay, second service is procrastinators, first service is not. That's cool, I'm with you, second service. Does anybody know how many days there are till Christmas at this point in time? 17, yeah, so there are 17 days till Christmas at this point in time, so now you have been warned, you have 15 more days to shop than you would have already, right? And so you are going to give gifts to people, probably that you love this Christmas, right? You may give a few gifts to people that you don't love because they're going to show up and it's just what you do, but most of the gifts that you give are going to be towards the people that you love. This is good. This is good not just because it's nice to love people. It's good because the heart of Christmas is giving. Why is the heart of Christmas giving? Because God gave his son, right? That's the whole point of Christmas. Would we have Christmas in our culture if we didn't celebrate the birth of Jesus? No, we just have Black Friday, right? We just... Hey guys, it's that time of year where you buy yourself presents again. Go out and get them cheap. No, it's this heart of Christmas is the gift of God's Son, Jesus Christ. And so the love that gives at Christmas is first and foremost God. God gives because he loves us. Now, how do I know this? I know this because he explicitly says this in the Bible. How many of you are familiar with the verse John 3:16? It's like the football verse, right? You can like put it on your cheeks. It's like John 3:16, and then all the other football players know you're a Christian, right? And then you get fined from the NFL. Anyways, that's a different issue. So, or maybe you've seen it in the stands during the game that somebody has like a big poster and they hold it up. And so lots of people know John 3:16. It's probably the most famous Bible verse that there is. And John 3:16 says this, "For God so loved the world," or God loved the world in this way and this much, that he what? That he gave his one and only son so that whoever believes in him shall not perish, but have everlasting life. Wow, that is a big gift, right? That is a huge gift. Now, if you thought that by giving your life, you could save someone you love, you would probably do it, right? That's that kind of love that says, I would take a bullet for you. Men, we pride ourselves in that, right? Like if we were to say that to our wives or our siblings, that'd be like a big statement of love. Like I would lay down my life for you. Would you lay down your kid's life willingly for someone that you love? I've got one mom who I love over here is like, no. I'm in the same boat. I would not. I have two of them, and I still wouldn't do it, right? You can give me more kids, and I'm not more likely to give up one of my kids for you. I love them more than me, and I will lay down my life for them, but I will not ask them to lay down their lives for you. God the Father looks at God the Son, and they together come up with this plan, and he says, I will give if you are willing, and they both say yes. God gives up his only begotten Son, which means his only unique Son, not his only created Son, his unique Son, his only Son, so that those who believe in him will not perish but have everlasting life. That is the gift of Christmas. Let us not forget the gift of Christmas as we give the lesser gifts of Christmas. Now, that doesn't make it wrong to give the lesser gifts of Christmas, right? I'm looking forward to Christmas Day. I love opening presents. I love giving presents and seeing them opened. It's very exciting, and it's a good thing as long as we give because God gave. And when it stops being about that, well, now we've made an idol, right? A sacred cow because of an emotional attachment that we have instead of a holiday that is all about the greatest giver of gifts and the greatest gift of all. So Christmas exists as a holiday about giving. But there's another aspect of love giving that I want to talk about with you. When you love someone, you will do anything for them, and you will give almost anything to them. So when I was in college, I was dating this girl, and she was amazing, and I was deeply in love with her. And Valentine's Day was rolling around, and I was just so excited to be able to give to her. I wanted this holiday that was about love to be about our love, which I thought was really big at the time, and it was, but now that I've been married for 16 years, it seems like small love because of how much experience I've had in marriage and the love that grows in marriage. But at the time, it was the most love that I had ever felt for a human in a romantic sense. And so as the holiday approached, I was getting really excited for what I was going to be able to do to show this love. But there's this really thing, this strange thing that happens in America around this holiday. Showing your love gets expensive at this holiday. Men, am I right? Have you felt this before? Yeah, have you noticed that the price of a rose jumps like 10,000% when you go to Costco between February 6th and February 13th? Like one day, two dozen roses is like $12.99, and then the next it's like $2,000. You're like, wow, I can fill up my gas tank for that. That's really expensive. And anyway, so I go to the store, and I'm a broke college student, and I start looking at the cards in the Valentine's section, and they're like $9 a card all of a sudden. And not only that, but they're more expensive, and they don't really match what I'm feeling inside. They're like cutesy, and they rhyme, but they seem pithy. They seem insignificant. And so I'm like, I don't know. I'm not going to spend $9 on something that doesn't really represent how I feel. And so I was like, I'll make a card instead. And so I went home, and I got some fancy paper out of the office, and I was like, oh, I need to make this pretty, but I'm a terrible artist. I'm the kind of guy that, like, my stick figures are lopsided and anatomically incorrect, and you're like, is that a human or a dog? And what is it doing to that tree? Like, I don't understand what's going on. I'm like, that's actually the girl and that's the man, you know? So you don't want me to draw a picture for you. That's a bad idea. And I didn't want to draw on this card. So I took it to my little brother who is an artist. And I was like, okay, John, I want you to make like this like climbing rose vine around it. And I want little flowers. And then I want like a big rose down here in the corner. And I need all this space in the middle because I'm going to write in it. And then he like did that in like 10 minutes. And I was like, wow, it looks like a flower with a vine. Another this is really pretty. Thank you. And so he drew that for me. And then I took it to my room, and I sat it down on the desk, and I started to write, and I made like a poem, and then I wrote like a little paragraph, and I signed my name in my best handwriting, which isn't very good still, nonetheless, and I like folded it up in a nice way and put it in a nice envelope and wrote her name on it very nicely in the envelope. I was like, yes. Well, while I was also in the store, I looked at the flower bouquets, and I'm like, oh, these look so good, and I'm walking up to the case, and then I like turn at the price tag, and I'm like, and I am so broke that I can't afford any of these, right? Like, even the single rose in the vase, I couldn't afford that. And like the dozen long-stem roses in the vase, I that was like a week's salary for me. I was like, ay. But thankfully, that store had a collection of like flowers that you could make an arrangement out of, and it was huge. It was this huge collection of these flowers. So I start collecting things, and I'm like comparing colors and like shape of the flowers. And do you know any 20-year-old guys who do that? No, me either. Looking back, I'm like, wow, I must have been in love, because like I go by the flowers, and I'm like, those are nice, but I'm still not very good at making them. But because of love, I was like, yes, I will do this. And I spent like 20 minutes comparing flowers and like getting 10 of them, and they were on sale, 10 for $22. And I was like, I can afford this probably. And so I took these things to the checkout aisle, and I bought them, and I went home, and I was like building this bouquet, and it took me like a long time. And I was cutting the flowers so that it was like this building pyramid of flowers, and it went up to the one rose that I could afford, and there were like lilies and irises, and there was like baby's breath and dragon's breath and I don't know what, but it was awesome when I finished it, because I poured all of the love that I had into this bouquet of flowers. And then I made this plan, right? I planned the gift, and I was looking forward to the time that I was going to give it with cheer. And I was like, okay, I can't get to her dorm before she leaves in the morning, because I was going to a Christian college, and they don't like men and women mixing except for during specific dorm room hours where the RAs are watching. So I couldn't go and give her the flowers. I was like, okay. And I didn't want to give her the flowers at class, because I knew that while she would feel loved, she would also feel inconvenienced. And she's the kind of lady that inconvenience and love don't go together. And so I'd have a better plan than that. And so I was like, I know what I will do. I will take it to her work. And so I went to her work before she got there at noon. She worked in an attorney's office with three attorneys who practiced family and real estate law. Really smart, incredibly wise Christian men. And I went there, and the problem was they were all a little bit intimidating to me. I don't know why they were intimidating, but they were at the time. And so I like went there, and I like knocked on the door, because it was lunchtime, and the administrator was gone. And that meant that one of the attorneys had to come and answer the door, which I didn't think about. It made it awkward and nervous. But I did it anyways, because I loved her. And then I took it in, and he let me put it on her desk, and I tucked the note in the flowers, and I was like, it's it. The love bomb is set. And I like walked away, and I went to my car, and I just waited for the phone call at the end of the day, because this was pre-cell phones, right? Like, this did not happen at that point in time. And it worked. She felt loved, because out of my love, I was giving to her, and I was giving to her my best. And I was giving to her something that was good for her to receive. And this is the nature of love giving. Love gives its first. Love gives its best. Love gives in a way that's timely. Love doesn't give in a way that makes itself greater. It gives in a way that makes the one who receives it greater, right? This is the nature of love giving. And this is the nature of our giving to God. In Proverbs, it says, honor the Lord out of your first fruits. This is Solomon, the wisest man on earth, writing to his son so that his son would know how to handle wealth and not be given over to greed and lust. And so he said, give to God your first, your best. In Malachi, the Lord is correcting his people, and they were giving sacrifices, but they were giving old blind sheep, the ones that couldn't mate, and the ugly ones that wouldn't make it in the flock, because it was inconvenient to give the best, because they were trying to build wealth for the nation. And God said, don't give your worst. Give the best and trust me with the rest. Give the best and trust me with the rest. He said, bring your tithes into the storehouse, and I will make all of your storehouses full. And he says this really weird thing. He says, test me in this. If you give out of love and trust, test me, and I will give back to you more than you can possibly give to me. And Jesus repeats that very same thing when he's giving the Sermon on the Mount. That's pretty crazy. That's the only thing that God says to test him in, is in your giving. Wow. And then to the Philippian church and the Corinthian church, Paul talks about giving. And when he talks to the Corinthian church, he says, look, you all promised to give me a gift out of love, but your gift is delayed, and that's okay. But I would encourage you, Give what's in your heart to give right now, and give cheerfully. But know this, that if you sow sparingly, you will reap sparingly. But if you sow generously, you will reap generously. In other words, God, the one who gives because he loves you, is inviting you into a journey of giving. A journey where you trust him and you give a little, and he gives you more back. Now, I'm not saying he's going to give you more back tangibly. He just says he's going to give you more back. And you know what? As you trust him and you give more, you will begin to get more and more back. Now, this is the very thing that I discovered on that cross-cultural mission trip, right? The more of myself that I gave to God out of love, the more I received back from him. Now, it's very interesting to me that for many of us, the story of that giving starts with our finances. Jesus tells us that where our treasure is, there our heart will be also. Where your heart is where you check up the most. For many of us, we spend more time worrying about our finances and the things that we get and the things that we'll wear and the things that we'll eat than we do seeking Jesus. And when we do that, we know where our treasure is. But when we begin to master our own money and tell it where to go and how it's going to serve the Lord, all of a sudden our heart starts to become his more and more. And the more that we give, the more that we realize that we're receiving from him. Now the thing is giving doesn't just stay with money. Giving becomes about giving yourself. For some of us, it's easier to write a check than to give an hour to someone else. It's easier to drop a tip in the offering basket than to volunteer to teach in the children's ministry or to help clean up the church on a served day or to go to the food bank and give a half a day away. And so we can give as a pattern financially while withholding the rest of ourselves from the Lord. That's not giving out of love, right? That's giving to get. I'm going to give in this way, God, so that you don't have to get the rest of me, so that I'm okay. This is why in Romans 12, Paul says, this is your true act of worship, that you would offer your life as a living sacrifice to God. He's saying, I don't want you to just give part of you. I don't want you to just give your finances. I want you to give all of you to the Lord so that your whole life is an offering to him. And that is the end of the journey of giving, that you would learn how to give or live your whole life as an offering to Christ. Now, when you do that, there's this beautiful thing that happens. Your life becomes consumed with Jesus, and you begin to experience the fullness of the love of God more and more in all circumstances. In other words, your life becomes like the life of Christ, who gave himself because he loved you. Now, we're going to transition into a time where we are taking communion together, and this is a table of love, right? It's a table where we give thanks and we recognize that the one who gave us everything is promising life to us when we trust in him. And so it's a table that we come to out of love for God and a desire for a deeper life with him. Because of that, it's a table that is reserved for those people who put their trust in Jesus. If you're in church today and you're just checking us out and you're getting to know who Jesus is and you haven't made that step of faith yet where you've chosen to say, I believe in you, Jesus, and I want to follow you, then please let these things go by. But if you've put your faith in Christ, would you take this time with us today to meditate on the love that God has for you, that he would give his one and only son so that because you believe, you have eternal life. Now, the other thing we do before we take this meal, this commemorative meal, is we take a moment to silently reflect between ourselves and God if there's a gap in our relationship. And we confess anything that's taken us away from God, and we turn again towards him, and we seek his face. We seek an intimate relationship with him. And so let's go ahead and do that now before we distribute the Lord's table.